Well, hello everybody, and welcome to our 66th program here in the externalization of the hierarchy. You know, some people think this is an easy book, very straightforward and maybe meant for understanding by those who have little occult training. But it really is not the case. In fact, what we really see with this book is some very deep material that requires real esoteric penetration. And I think it's one of the books that I've neglected over the years, except, you know, for references here and there, and I find myself getting a lot out of this. Well, we've had five activities to which the Christ is dedicated at this time: the reorganization of the world religions, the gradual dissolution of Orthodox Judaism, and of course he was one who attempted to really fulfill the law under Judaism some 2,000 years ago, preparation for a revelation which will inaugurate the new era, the adjustments of hierarchy to Shambhala impress, and a much closer relationship between hierarchy and humanity. If we realize that these are factors upon which the Christ is concentrating, and this was back 74 years ago, we'll realize how important somehow they still are. So many of these things still have work to be done. We must eliminate the hate between people. Dictators with divided psyches try to organize society according to their warped point of view, and that must not be allowed. But they are standing out, and people see who they are, and they see their psychological malfunction. And before long, I suspect that they will not be tolerated. That will be better for all of humanity. Now we're here on 66, and we go on. These various efforts may appear to the casual reader as relatively unimportant. This is a superficial point of view, and one which meets with little sympathy from the hierarchy. Well, I've just listed five factors, and DK tells us they're liable to be discounted as being important. And then he says, well, if that is the case, it is based on superficial assessment. These adjustments within hierarchy to the weight of shambolic will and the movement of hierarchy towards humanity, these are of the utmost moment. And when you look at the original three, out of the religious approach can come a great war, which would require that Shambhala be involved, which DK says has never yet been the case in a human war, and could lead to the destruction of humanity. And the Orthodox approach in the Jewish group, well, it doesn't seem very harmful today, but it is the seed of resistance against the Christ force. And this is not to say that there are not many fine people, good people, in these groups. It just depends how much their mind may be dominated by the ancient prohibitions and the deep-seated guilt which seems to accompany the Jewish group. And then the new revelation, whatever that is, inaugurating the new age and setting the tone, the notes for the new world religion. This kind of reform is absolutely necessary. Some of the most dangerous groups are the militant Abrahamic groups, whether we're talking about militant Christianity or militant Islam. I think from the Jewish group, there's not so much of that, but it can represent an obstructive force and a crystallization which must be transcended. Now, this was a while ago, and I think there has been progress along this line. So these are not inconsequential matters, and to discount them as not very important is, in the eyes of hierarchy, superficial and doesn't evoke much sympathy from the hierarchy. That the Jews should be rid of fear is of major importance, that they should know and recognize the Christ as the Messiah, and therefore find for themselves that the religion they follow is destructive of many of the finer values, is likewise of importance. That Orthodox Judaism, along with all other faiths, should realize that there is no desire to make them Christian in the ordinary sense of the term. In old days, of course, there was. The conversion pressure was immense in other countries, like Spain and Italy, let's say. But that they should all move towards some loving synthesis and eliminate their mutual antagonisms and rivalries is equally urgent, and this statement includes the Christian faiths as well. So let's just say important developments that must be accomplished. The fear, of course, promotes hatred. Man hates what he fears. And that hatred can lead to the stockpiling of lethal weaponry. I know that after the war, there was this motto, never again, and it's easy to understand why it developed. At the same time, lessons have to be learned concerning this loving synthesis of which the Tibetan speaks. All religions at their root, unless terribly distorted, are after the same thing, and better and more spiritual quality of life. Somehow a release, as the mystics understand it, from entrapment in a very low level of experience that we have become accustomed to which we are habituated. But there's so much more, and the Jewish mystic knows this as well as the Christian mystic and the Sufi mystic. They all know that higher and beyond the conventionality of ordinary religion lie states which are joyful and blissful and encourage love and sharing and unity. And so many people, unfortunately, are still falling short of this kind of realization because they have, let us say, the Orthodox concrete mind. Whether it's Orthodox Christianity or Judaism or Islam, there's lots of trouble in the Abrahamic religions, unfortunately. And that's because this lunar god, Jehovah, is associated with them. And this is not a benevolent being. It is not Almighty God. It's not the planetary logos. But then these distinctions are meaningless to most of the people who embrace fearfully their religion. There's as much a fearful embrace of dogmatism in Christianity and Islam as there is in Judaism. It's a hanging on for dear life to forms which stultify the growth of the inner human being. It's most unfortunate, but fading, and with certain discoveries in science, it will fade out entirely. Science and religion will come together and prove certain wonderful facts about the nature of life, and then we can drop those aspects of religion which are based on a fearful attitude, based on annihilation, based on an eternity of hellfire from an all-merciful God. You know, it's the illogic in which so many human beings indulge is a terrifying thing, appalling thing. And we hope that through our educational programs, that kind of attitude, which has trained so many in a stultifying orthodoxy, that attitude will be dissipated. We have here more about the Vatican. There have been many changes, of course. Reform in that church, and John the 23rd was instrumental in that type of reform. And we have now a pope who is reforming, Pope Francis. He's taken the name of the great peacemaker, Francis of Assisi, who became Saint Francis. He was sainted. He had a lot of Libra in his chart, and peace eventually, you know, between the human kingdom and the lesser kingdoms was something that radiated from him. He's said to be a very high initiate. And I still think on the sixth ray, but not the initiate we know as Master Kutumi. Some people, I think, believe that to be the case, but the rays are different as far as I can see. And the degree of scholarliness of Kutumi compared with that of Francis shows the difference in orientation. Saint Francis, I'm speaking of. But the present Francis is a man who seeks the welfare of humanity, and I would say all humanity, although many disagree with him and think that he should just stick to religious matters. But I guess he's one of those who understands that spirituality is greater than religiosity. And that is an attitude that must be adopted by conventionally religious people. We have a tendency to believe that religiosity is the one spiritual avenue to be followed. But that, as the Tibetan points out, is an attitude which represents a victory for the thought process which the Lords of Form, the Black Lodge, seek to induce in the human psyche. That the Vatican cease its political scheming, you know, it has a Ray 3 personality, its exploitation of the masses, and its emphasis upon ignorance is as important. I suppose the Vatican here at this time is being accused of withholding the benefits of education from the masses. If you keep the masses in ignorance, they will be true believers and follow every edict or even suggestion from the church. They will not think for themselves. And so you have the preservation of a kind of class distinction between the priestcraft, highly educated, and the masses, which are not allowed to progress through education. I think, you know, many improvements have been made in this line. That the manifold divisions of the Protestant churches be bridged is imperative. We have so many splinter groups that pride themselves almost on the distinctions that they hold in comparison with other splintered groups. And so often it's just a tiny little difference. I mean, there are people who believe that unless you are totally immersed when baptized, it's not baptism. And there are others who don't believe in total immersion. I mean, it gets so that concrete detail kills the spirit, which is meant to emerge from certain sacraments, certain rites. And of course, people are, the concrete mindedness is the problem, isn't it? During the next 2,000 years, when there's a sub-6 to the fifth root race, the abstract mind will be much further developed. And this we can see will be occurring during the age of Aquarius. Think about Immanuel Kant, you know. There is an abstract mind, and here he is with Aquarius rising. Aviation is connected with Aquarius and the ability to go high and to see from a much higher and broadened perspective. And this is even though he was in his sun sign, a Taurus, but of course lots of third ray, which would bring in the abstract mind. So all these divisions, which sometimes are laughable, ridiculous, you know, we believe this, you believe that, we're different from you, and our approach is true and yours is not. I mean, isn't it separative? If none of these things happen, humanity is headed towards a religious war which will make the past war appear like child's play, you know, and now the weaponry exists for that prophecy to be fulfilled. Antagonisms and hatreds would embroil entire populations, and the politicians of all the nations will take full advantage of the situation to precipitate a war which may well prove the end of humanity. There are no hatreds so great or so deep as those fostered by religion. This is a quotation that I've brought forward many times. And it is a warning, isn't it? There are moments when epidemics, pandemics seem to cover up this dire possibility. There are political situations, riots, uprisings, and so forth, which cover up this possibility. But when those things subside, the possibility is there. If we don't cure this virulent militant separatism based on the sixth ray and the concrete mind, the idée fixe almost of orthodox religions which prevent the free play of love. So we are warned, and this is a warning that came back in 1946. Now he says, if none of these things happen, he didn't say if all of these things do not happen, and maybe something is happening. Certainly the consciousness movement of the 60s and 70s went a long way to widening people's understanding of what is reality. Still, certain groups held firm to their fear-laden orthodoxy. And there is a reawakening, has been for some decades, of those old, rigid approaches which feature the heaven and hell syndrome. I think at one point DK says there is no hell if it's not the physical plane itself. But we can ask ourselves, what is it in the human psyche which which brings forward such a sadistic idea of eternal damnation from a newly visited upon a newly created soul simply because an emotional choice about belief has not been made? And then, of course, we kind of wonder about all the great people that have existed for millions of years and whether they too, not being able to have the opportunity even to believe in Jesus as the Savior or Muhammad as the last prophet, whether they find themselves in this eternal state of hellfire. Doesn't make sense, does it? But then the human race is not yet very intelligent throughout its rank and file. Perhaps those who came from the moonchain or from the previous solar system, having had more experience, are likely to reject these childish and sadistic solutions. I'm recalling DK talked about two planets, if we can call them that, fairly near the Earth that are responsible for the sadism and cruelty sometimes found in children of a certain age. And maybe humanity is still much affected by those planets which seem to carry no blessing, no goodwill. They seem to carry a certain hatred and sadistic horror, and they are effective. Now, he doesn't say too much about them, and wisely so. Then you think about the satellites of Mars. The Theosophy tells us Mars has no right to. It's a Phobos and Deimos, something of that nature. And their sort of fear and terror. One wonders about the usefulness of such energy centers, but humanity is afflicted by fear and terror. And looks for solutions to be saved from the very unpleasant imaginings prompted by this deeply fearful state and even the terror that goes with it. So we still have a lot of work to do, don't we, in becoming civilized and not giving in to kind of a childish sadism which ruled during the days of the Inquisition. It was a horrible period. You kind of wonder what kind of antecedents it may have had in previous civilizations, maybe Atlantean civilizations, those kinds of antecedents would prompt the Tibetan to say, as he has said, that humanity has erred grievously. It's something you almost don't want to think about because, you know, we were all involved in those Atlantean misdeeds. Maybe there are some souls who came in partially formed during Aryan times, but certainly nothing near the majority. The Christ, therefore, says the Tibetan, has to add to all the many objectives which occupy his attention, still another, to avert a final war. This incipient war, meaning one for which the seeds already exist and for which a initial movement already exists, this incipient war is contrary to the will to good of the Lord of the world and any world plan. It can be averted by goodwill, and this is the most important statement in this message as far as humanity is concerned. Maybe others who are of higher rank will find other things of equal import. And so I want to sort of really highlight this, a final war, which would set back the progress of our planetary logos significantly. Now remember, the progress of our planetary logos is deeply related to the progress of our solar logos, who could achieve even the fifth cosmic initiation in this solar system if our planet, representing the base of the spine, is sufficiently evolved. At least that's how I see it. But it will, our solar logos will achieve the fourth cosmic initiation. The question of the fifth has to do with its own progress and the progress of different planets, which represent different chakras within the solar logos, our Earth being particularly related to the base of the spine, which is the major center involved in the fifth initiation, believe it or not. So here's the Christ with his effort to avert a final war. Remarkable when one thinks about the danger in which we all live without realizing it. I think I'd like to get those all more or less of the same size. Would that be so bad? All right. Though these are deep issues with which the hierarchy must concern itself, and the Christ as the leader of hierarchy must concern himself especially. He cannot act as savior to an entirely failed humanity. And we are told that there is the possibility that the whole experiment of raising up a proper humanity would have to be begun again. Well, we do have, in a way, all the time in the world, and eventually there is a resolution into the universal logos, but the quality of the experience is at stake. And it is so easy to delay the good and force ourselves to experience a great degradation. Master Moria comments on how rapidly, for instance, a nation can fall down due to its leadership. How precipitous can be the decline. And we see that. You know, the fall of Rome was well documented. It seemed to take a long time, and the historian Gibbon was remarkable in being able to detail the causes of the fall of the Roman Empire. But these days, with the advanced technology, the fall can be even more rapid and precipitous. I read today, of course, you know, it may be a long time, maybe the distant past, if you get this far, but China has called the United States a failed state. Is it? I mean, there's all kinds of political and power dynamics going on between these two countries, but you see how unwise and even maleficent leadership, if you can call it that, can lead to the destruction of the major values which once made a country a great country, or an example to be held before the eyes of other nations. So anyway, this whole thing about the averting the final war and how it's contrary to the will to good, of Sanat Kumara and of any world plan, really, can be averted by goodwill. So even though it sometimes may seem to be an innocuous dynamic, that is goodwill, it is essential when it comes to the preservation of humanity. And then he says, this is the most important statement in this message as far as humanity is concerned. So let's take it in, you know. We live in dangerous times, more dangerous than we may know. And now our weaponry is sufficient to bring these dire prophecies to fruition. So let's think behind the scenes of the real dangers, and not just the passing struggles. Great and stirring events are imminent, says the Tibetan, and they will take place when the effect of the new invocation is more pronounced and its use more general. And we're talking about the third stanza here, you know. Two stanzas having been given out in 35, 36, and 1940. So we're talking about from the point of light within the mind of God, etc. So the Tibetan sees the future here, which doesn't mean that the desirable future events will always occur at the moment that it would be desirable for them to occur. They can be delayed. So the new invocation has to be used, and of course since this time it has been widely used and has been translated into so many languages, I think well over 100. This is primarily the responsibility of those who are affiliated with the three movements which demonstrate the part I have sought to take in world preparation. And that's basically what the Tibetan is doing. He is helping to prepare humanity, especially from the educational and educational angle and regarding triangles and the goodwill work and the healing work. His work has been vast when we come to understand the usual scope of our consciousness. So what are these movements? The Arcane School, and this refers primarily to the books for which I am responsible. And think of it, now the CD-ROM exists and everything is sped up greatly in terms of the potential for assimilation, understanding and assimilation. He asks us to be organizing for speed. So the Arcane School and the books, the triangles, which constitutes a deeply esoteric mode of working, yet one of extreme simplicity, and the goodwill movement, which has in it a factor of major importance. In that, this movement, embracing already as it does many, many thousands, and hopefully by now millions, seeks to promote right human relations with its acute and immediate appeal to the masses. It is this that the masses want, essentially, and is oft what lies behind the things which they do and the plans which they make, so often ignorantly and disastrously. So these are the factors that of preparation in which the Tibetan has involved himself. And there are so many of us who have benefited from this triple aspect. Think of it, 100 years ago, Alice Bailey was starting the Arcane School. 101 years ago, or not even that, 100 years and a half a year, she first heard from the Tibetan. Maybe a note sounded in her ear, and a relationship was continued, I must say continued, which proved a benefit to so many thousands of people, with us among them. Some of us might wonder, what would our life be like if the Bailey teaching had not come forward? And theosophists can wonder the same. I think Blavatsky has said there are some people for whom theosophy is the last hope. Are we such? You will note that my outstanding theme is that of world planning. This is what the Tibetan says. This is the main preoccupation of the hierarchy. This planning falls into two categories, and for these, the Christ is responsible. So, world planning, will, purpose, and plan, as is presented in the tabulation that we went over a short time ago. And in that tabulation, there are many difficult concepts that need to be adjusted to each other. It's not just, oh, here comes another list, you know. No, it really requires deep thinking to see the relationship. The urge to formulate a plan. Well, humanity is much ruled by the third ray, and the externalizing hierarchy has to take into consideration the third ray. Purpose on the second ray as a subsidiary aspect of the first ray, and will on the first ray. These are three factors with which we must become more and more familiar and live in a way that is helpful to the establishing of the emerging plan. Will first, purpose next, and then plan. So what is it then that the Christ must do in relation to this planning? What is it? Because we can be sure that if he must do it, he is doing it. That's the thing about hierarchy. They are good to their word. They do not break their word. If they commit themselves, they do so with full realization and responsibility. They know that they must follow through. And although it's hard to get across to people who are beginners in this field, and to a certain extent, people like you and like me are beginners, is that He who puts his hand to the plow and turns back is not worthy to enter the kingdom of heaven. And by that kingdom of heaven, we certainly don't just mean the Devachan world, post-mortem, you know, between lives. We mean the cosmic ethers, really. One can be in the kingdom of heaven and be right here in the face of all of these normal perceptions, and it's still the kingdom of heaven if one has the sensitivity to realize it. So, for what is the Christ responsible? Number one, the esoteric preparation for the physical appearance or the material emergence of the hierarchy on earth. With this activity, the Buddha is definitely associated, and it is connected with his final service to mankind. Now, this is a very important little paragraph, very important, because it fills in the blanks and it tells us a bit about the Christ's engineering of the reappearance and how the Buddha, although we might not expect it, if in fact the Waysak yearly appearance is now terminated, how the Buddha is really working for the externalization. So working assiduously, working emphatically, and in ways that we will not understand, but of course he's one of the members of the triangle surrounding the Christ. And his final service to mankind. I guess, you know, the so-called sin of the Buddha is that he stayed with humanity too long out of love and compassion. But by now, you know, he knows and he sees the result. And he understands that he must move on to take his place, as DK says, within the solar hierarchy. Now, that is really a piece of occult information if people think that from this book you will get only a collection of rather understandable essays. So, the esoteric preparation for the physical appearance or material emergence of the hierarchy on earth. And with this activity, the Buddha is definitely associated. Well, you know, Taurus is an earth sign and can lend itself to earthly preparations. And what else is the Christ maybe responsible for? The establishing by all means available of right human relations. This, as it is achieved, will swing the ashrams gradually into external activity as need arises, you know, what's called for at the moment, and it involves the constant cooperation of the masters. So it's not that all ashrams will appear simultaneously. They appear according to need, and they intervene according to need. So let's just call this two factors for which the Christ, you'd think that a little E would be possible. There you go. For which the Christ is responsible. Yes, that's a faster way of doing it. Right human relations. It's a theme within Shambhala. It's a condition which has not been achieved. Everywhere we look, we find the rising up of wrong human relations based upon the desire to acquire power over others. Recently, although it may be a long time in the past when you read this or listen to this, the word dominate has been used. That's not about right human relations. People are rebelling against systemic racism in American society, and the administration in charge says law and order forces must dominate those legitimate protests, even when they're peaceful. Dominate, you see. In our particular solar system, the first ray has not been introduced in really great measure. It's temporarily held back while the concentration is upon the second ray and the consciousness aspect. In the next solar system, that will be different. But in terms of the spread of time, a long time must elapse. I mean, solar systems, according to the secret doctrine, last some 311,040,000,000,000 years, or at least, you know, maybe 300 trillion years. And if there is a pause between solar systems of approximately equal length to the manifestational cycle of a solar system, that's a long time. We have to investigate these figures, but if we find that there really exists, since we're halfway through our solar system, approximately 450 trillion years before the next solar system arises, the will system, then we are dealing with extraordinary lengths of time, at least as far as our normal assessment of time goes. Now, some groups feel that those figures are greatly exaggerated, but Blavatsky seems to come down in favor of the accuracy of these Brahmanical chronicles. Since 1931, I have hinted at much of this. Now, that's when he really began to gather together his students in the various C groups, a project which still is incomplete, but has another 175 years to run, probably. And my activities carried forward with these things in view. And he says, and my activities have followed the sequence outlined below. So this is the Tibetan. Speaking of his work, it's very important somehow to understand what he had in mind and to evaluate where we are in bringing that forward. This is the Tibetan work. Since 1931, he has been hinting at the Christ's responsibility for the emergence of the hierarchy and the establishment of right human relations. You know, it's like fighting children, isn't it? You think about how a parent looks on at the battles between brothers and sisters, or between brothers and between sisters. And the parent understands that maybe none of this is really necessary, but to the little children involved in the fray, it seems like something important that must be engaged in. So the Tibetans work, I have attempted to reach certain people in order to see how far an ashram could function in external form on earth. And these would be his students to whom he wrote the letters and gave the training in Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1 and 2. It has proved only a partial success, and the results of my experiment have been given in the book Discipleship in the New Age. Remember, this is the book we're supposed to use to draw people towards the ashram. The effects of the experiment upon the individuals involved have not proved encouraging. He's being very frank here. The effect upon the esotericists and aspirants of the world has been most successful and has greatly enhanced the sense of reality so essential to the recognition of the hitherto unseen hierarchy. So those who were involved were maybe supposed to be of a somewhat higher caliber and capable of being gathered around an ashram, at least externally and peripherally, and with them, mixed success. But for those he calls the esotericists and aspirants, it has been successful. Now, of course, I'm pausing here to think which is higher than which. I think he would have. Does he mean the established esotericists and the true aspirants? Of course, all of those in his group were considered to be true aspirants if true aspirants had taken the first initiation, that is, all but one individual. Well, let's just say that it's hard to think that the experiment showed that an ashram could be established on Earth at that time. So he knew these people, he had a karmic relationship with them, and he wanted to see if they could be gathered into the external form of an ashram. Well, there was some success, partial. And we can judge for ourselves what the degree of success may have been by reading Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2. And one, of course, one is even more so. And then the next point is that, I think I'll just make this a little bigger. I published books, he says, which gave the new esoteric teaching, founded on the past, of service today and indicative of the future. In those books, I isolated for the new generation of esoteric students the truths which were true, extracting them from the mass of imaginative thinking, because there's so much of that even now, you know, today, and it leads people into the realm of glamour. And consequent formulation of thought forms which esotericists since the time of HBB have so consistently created and presented to the inquiring public as true. So he had a great sifting to go through here to help us discriminate the true from the false. And so many of us do not want to relinquish what we consider to be true, even if it's not. So I indicated the new truths, which were of significance for the future and for which the truths of the past were a needed foundation, and gave enough in outline and in seed concepts to show the lines along which the new world religion, the new political regimes, and the new social order could be set up. I gave you the blueprints, he says. I enunciated these as principles, leaving men free, as must ever be the case, to work out the details according to their contributing civilizations and their peculiar national cultures, which should unitedly create a beautiful whole and not provide barriers of separativeness, as is the case today. This is, you know, he's giving, he's stimulating, but he's not binding by giving all. Master Moria tells us that to give all is to weaken the one to whom it is given. It is to bind them. I finally brought to the attention of the public the idea of the externalization, that the externalization of the hierarchy was a major hierarchical project for which due preparation would have to be made. So what all did the Tibetan do here? So he clarified what was imaginative thinking and what was really the truth on which we could rely, and he gave the necessary seeds for a new religion, new politics, new social order, and leaving us to work out these things based upon his definite statements and upon his hints, and not to cut all from the same mold. He allowed for the difference in civilizations and national cultures. And then he spoke of the externalization of the hierarchy, a great incentive. Well, this, I think, can be continued in the next program. The first two points about his activities, attempting an ashramic externalization of a minor and testing type, and publishing books which really were extremely useful in helping to bring a clearer idea of what the coming civilization must be and the coming parts of that civilization. Then in the next program, we'll go on with a few other things that he did. We are on page 548, 547. We're just reaching 548. And I believe we didn't start so very far ahead from that point. 548. Okay. Now let me just gather this together. And get ready to go on with another program, program 67. All right, and with this, I think we can get rid of. So we've completed program 66, and it's about an hour and 5 minutes or so. And it's from 5:45 to 5:48. And it's undertaken on the 3rd of June. And we're beginning with program 67. And we don't know, it will be today, I trust, the 3rd of June. And we don't know how long it will be, not yet. So, friends, we see how the hierarchy plans for humanity and yet leaves a significant amount of the work in the hands and feet, by human hands, by human feet, of the hierarchy. Actually, we human beings, from head, heart, and our active appendages have to do much on our own, otherwise we will never learn. But we've seen, you know, that hierarchy is doing everything it can to bring forward the new possibilities for humanity. And he's reviewing right now everything from 1931 onward, how he has tried to reach us, and how the Christ is working. There are several items here that we'll be dealing with. And this should be a continuation, continue numbering. And hopefully, Well, anyway, this is number 2. And I think we have to understand that, and then we go on to number 3. So, let's continue our studies and gather this sense of how hierarchy has attempted to assist us to enter a new civilization, the principles of which are very different from those which have ruled previous civilizations, and how hierarchy has helped us prepare many of us to enter the fifth kingdom of nature, the kingdom of souls, through the process of initiation. All right, that ought to be enough for right now, and lots of love, many blessings, and we'll see you soon.